Hello, fellow foodies. I am thrilled to be here with acclaimed author and fellow avid botanist, Professor Victoria Johnson. She is a former Mellon Visiting Scholar at the New York Botanical Garden and is currently an Associate Professor of Urban Policy and Planning at Hunter College in New York City, where she teaches on the history of philanthropy, nonprofits, and New York City. She holds a doctorate in sociology from Columbia University and an undergraduate degree in philosophy from Yale. Victoria is visiting us here in Atlanta for a lecture and book signing that she'll be giving later tonight at the Atlanta Botanical Gardens, which is co-sponsored by the Emory University Herbarium. Her book, American Eden, tells the fascinating life story of Dr. David Hossack, a physician and botanist who dedicated his life to the power of healing with both plants and surgery. After his training in Europe, Hossack returned to the U.S., where he founded the country's first public botanical garden, named Elgin Gardens after his father's hometown in Elgin, Scotland. Hossack had a tremendous impact on the early days of botany and medicine in the New Republic. As is summarized on the book website, and I quote, "From the meadows of Manhattan and correspondents around the world, Hossack collected over 2,000 species at his 20-acre botanical garden. He used these plants to conduct some of the first pharmaceutical research in the United States and to experiment with new crops. In his enormous conservatory, Hossack introduced New Yorkers to ornamental flowers, shrubs, and trees from as far away as Japan, Madagascar, and the Cape of Good Hope. He had coffee trees, tamarind trees, and bananas, flame lilies, bird of paradise flowers, and sweet-scented daphne that greeted visitors to his American Eden. Today, Radio City Music Hall sits on the footprint of Hossack's conservatory. His land is home to the Rockefeller Center." I was so fortunate to receive an advanced copy of Victoria's masterpiece, and I just knew that it would be a big hit. I'm so excited to finally meet her in person and to have her here on the show. I hope that you enjoy this discussion of Hossack and the relevance of plants to the field of medicine as we explore his Garden of American Eden. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Victoria. It's been such a pleasure to meet you, and I'm a huge fan of your work, obviously. Hossack is just a hero for anyone interested in botany and medicine, and you wrote so eloquently about his life and all of the challenges and exciting things that he experienced, and I'm just really happy to have you on the show. And I know our audience will love learning more about this, you know, really foundational character in the history of early America.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a dream of a couple of years to get to meet you and see your lab. I've been following your research from afar, and I think of you, as you know, as the modern day David Hossack. So it's super exciting to be here.
And that's, like, I think the greatest compliment anyone has ever given me, because he's just amazing. So let's get into it. For our audience, maybe we can start with, maybe if you could just give us a bit of a background on who was David Hossack and what inspired you to write this book about his life.
David Hossack was, he was really famous in his day, and most people haven't heard of him now. I came across him because I was really interested in botanical gardens, and I was thinking about doing a book on botanical gardens in New York City, and there are a number of them. And I started reading a wonderful book about the founding of the New York Botanical Garden in the 1890s, and it had a couple of pages about this man who had founded the first public botanical garden in the United States.
So he was the founder of the first botanical garden.
The first public. I always make that distinction because Bartram's Garden is such an important American garden, and that was founded in 1728 outside Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. This was the first institution that was meant as, designed as a public, a state institution. And as we'll talk about, it took him a long time to make people aware of what he was trying to do. And so he had to start this garden privately first, and then it finally the state came to its senses and realized how important botany is, and particularly medical botany. So David Hossack was born in Manhattan in 1769, And he had a really tumultuous childhood because he grew up during the American Revolution when New York was occupied by the British. And that had a huge impact on his life and work.
And he spent some time in Britain as well, I think, in his early days of training. Can you tell us a bit about that? And who would have been his contemporaries during this period?
Yeah. So he, when he was growing up and he was surrounded by blood and death and disease on the streets of New York with soldiers, you know, wounded soldiers being carried past him down the cobblestones on stretchers, he began to dream of becoming a doctor. In his teens, he enrolled at Columbia College. So the revolution was over, and he enrolled at Columbia College, which had been recently renamed. It was King's College, and he started studying medicine. But what he discovered quickly was that a lot of his professors there and during subsequent studies in Philadelphia had studied in Britain. And Hussack later said that this was in part because the best training in the Western world in medicine was in Britain, but it was also because even though Americans were really proud of their young nation, they really liked their doctors to come with European credentials because they weren't quite sure yet about their own institutions. Yeah. It was a very exciting young nation. And so he went over to Edinburgh to get that training.
And this is at a time, too, right, where you had really surgical procedures were almost like theater. In fact, the operating theater was where you would have procedures done, and you had students and the public that would sometimes attend as well.
Yeah. Hussack loved surgery and dissection. Those were his favorite classes at first. He loved anatomy. He even got involved in the doctor's mob in New York, this riot that happened in 1788 when he was an undergraduate. He heard that a mob was attacking the Columbia anatomy lab because dissection was really, it was kind of contested, partly because the bodies came from grave robbing. And so he raced to Columbia to protect the specimens, and he got bashed on the head, and he almost got killed. But he, in Britain, that was being practiced with much more acceptance by the late 18th century, dissection and anatomy. And those were really the pursuits he loved until he discovered botany.
So tell us about this. Botany, of course, at the time was a discipline that was really led by men, and because it was almost considered a bit sexual after Linnaeus came up with, you know, using the reproductive parts as a way of plants, as a way of categorizing plants by the binomial system. So what was it like for him to walk into this world of botany coming from the I guess, enchantment with surgery and anatomy, and then he had that aha moment, right?
He, you know, a lot of surgeries killed patients or at least didn't save them. And the time he was working in, you know, studying medicine we would think of it as very primitive. It was the end of the tail end of the humoral approach to the body. So there was a lot of bloodletting. There was a lot of use of things like mercury to purge the body of offending fluids and solids, you know, sort of instantaneously. In Britain, he discovered that another set of doctors were trying to discover new medicinal plants. And most of the medicines at this time came from plants. But what Hussack discovered was that his American medical training had not prepared him for the sophistication with which botany was being taught and studied in Britain. He went for, this is the defining moment of his life, as I think of it, you know, of his young years. He was walking in a garden in Edinburgh with his one of his professors and a bunch of students. And he later said, quote, "I was very much mortified by my ignorance of botany." And from that moment, he decided he was going to learn everything he could about the plant world. And he learned not only that doctors did know a lot of plants and plant medicines, and they were gentler than these really kind of dramatic treatments, surgical interventions, but he also learned that no one really knew what made a particular plant effective against a given illness. This was very, very early in the world of chemistry and, you know, pre-pharmaceutical industry. And he learned that no one quite knew how plants were related across you know, across classes, what kinds of medicines you might find across a set of plants. How would you conduct experiments that would allow you to identify new plants in the wild? I know I'm talking to somebody who does this in the most cutting edge way. This was kind of very early days for this, even though there was a lot of medicinal plants that have been used for millennia, of course. But for Western doctors, they were really trying, they're kind of in the dark, trying to figure out what's a surefire way to identify new medicines and has it caught fire with a passion for medical botany.
It's amazing. You know, and it's funny, in some ways, not that much has changed when we think about understanding some of the secrets behind a lot of these medicinal plants. There was a report that came out from Kew Gardens, I guess within the last year or so, on the state of the world's plants. And they noted there are over 28,000 species that have been used in some way in human medicine. But if you look at the scientific literature, we've only really investigated a few hundred of those at best. And right. So, you know, it's still something that we're fighting to understand and explore. And, you know, I think in his day, it was all about the medicinal virtues. Right. And what was it like when he came back to the Americas? Did he have a realization that there were plants in the Americas that were also worth studying?
Yeah. This is also the era when there were some doctors were still relying on the doctrine of signatures. And I know some people today feel that there might be some truth to the doctrine of signatures, that it might be a mnemonic device to remember the medicinal properties of given plants. What Husick did before he came back from Edinburgh was he went to London for a year just to study botany. He studied with the greatest botanist in Britain, William Curtis, who not everybody's heard of today, but he was the greatest practical botanist in all of Britain. And he had a botanical garden outside London, which I went there and it's not there anymore. It's not been there for 200 years. But I went and stood on the street corner with my eyes closed, with buses whizzing by, trying to recapture what this botanical garden would have been like for Husick in the 1790s, studying in Britain. And Curtis would take his students out into the field, much as you do, and show them how plants looked growing in the wild, because studying plants in books was... You know, that was how Husick had learned about plants in the United States. And it simply wasn't.
Except, so much more of a sensory experience when you're able to kind of smell and touch and even
see how it's growing in the wild, its habit. And so Husick went on these botanizing excursions with William Curtis. And then the other thing he did that was absolutely life-changing for him was that he started studying at the Linnaean Society of London, which had been founded about 10 years earlier. Husick became very close with James Edward Smith, who had been the founder. And he began studying with Sir Joseph Banks.
Oh,
there.
My gosh.
That's like right. Rock star.
Yeah, rock star botany as well. I mean, it's just amazing the people that he interacted with in his lifetime. I mean.
Yeah. So when Husick sailed home, he really impressed both Banks and Smith. And when he sailed home to the United States in the summer of 1794, Smith gave him as a present a set of duplicate Linnaean specimens.
Original
Linnaean specimens that he had duplicates of. Those have since been lost, but I just dream of finding them somewhere in an archive in the U.S. But this is a show of what an incredible botanist Husick was, even in his early 20s, that Smith would entrust him with this kind of treasure. And Banks and Smith and Husick all stayed in touch for the rest of their lives. And Husick became, with Banks and Smith's help, Husick was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of London years later, which is an enormous honor for an American.
And he was the first American to have this honor,
yes,
correct?
Yeah.
Wow.
Husick stayed in touch with Smith and Banks for the rest of their lives, and he was so admired by them that Smith helped Husick become the first member of the Linnaean Society who was not just a foreign fellow, but was a full-fledged member. Mm-hmm. And then Banks helped him later, helped Husick become elected as a Fellow of the Royal Society, which was an absolutely extraordinary honor for an American. And there weren't many of them, even in the among the founding fathers and so on.
That's amazing. And, you know, when Husick came back to the Americas, it wasn't all a joyous occasion, right? What had been happening while he was abroad training?
Well, he came back to a country that was very divided politically. And this is, you know, the French Revolution is raging. And in the U.S., there was, we think today is divisive. This was,
tumultuous time.
Really, fighting in the streets and of New York and duels left and right. And Husek came back and was quickly appointed a professor of botany and pharmacology, Materia Medica, it was called then, at Columbia, even though he was a very young man. But this was on the strength of this incredible education he had just gotten. And he would tell his students, he taught them about Linnaeus. He was so proud. He would always kind of name drop Banks and Smith in his lectures, wouldn't we all?
Well, of course, exactly.
And he told them that the United States deserved doctors just as skilled and knowledgeable as Europe's, and they deserved a full-fledged research institution in the form of a botanical garden.
Yeah. Well, and this is a time, too, where not only it's a time when you also still face a lot of deaths of children at early ages and deaths through childbirth, and there was a lot of medical need that could be approached, I guess, really well, not only with the surgical skills he'd gained, but also his botanical skills.
Absolutely. Husek himself, he saved many lives. He lost 3 infants of his own, and he lost 2 wives to illness. So even a doctor wasn't immune to the devastation of personal tragedy. He turned this personal tragedy into even more drive and passion for medicine. He made obstetrics his specialty.
Mm-hmm.
His most moving writings in some ways are about being in the birthing room and how a doctor must be absolutely ready and prepared and show self-confidence. But his most poetic writing is about plants and botany.
Yes.
That was his love and joy.
So let's jump to the point where he has this major decision point to create this public botanical garden. Was it easy to do this? What was it like for him to take this step?
So he was working in an era when not only did his fellow Americans not really understand, most of them, didn't really understand the point of botany when a lot of the country was covered with forests and fields. And the legislators, when he was trying to get funding from the state of New York, they said, they said, why, when the state of New York is covered with plants, why in the world would we fence some of it off and study them? And other people made fun of his ideas. You know, he wanted a country estate for himself. He wanted to pasture cows. And, he really
got
a lot of...
They just didn't get it.
They didn't get it.
They didn't get it, yeah.
And he was also working in an era when the kind of institution... There weren't 501c3s. There weren't the organizational infrastructure that we're used to being able to choose from and the legal infrastructure. It wasn't in place. So he had to invent a kind of organization that was a sort of a fusion of a research institution, a kind of charitable institution, a membership society. There wasn't an actual organizational form that worked for him because the country was so young. And so he had a double challenge. But one of his allies wrote anonymously, I love this line, wrote anonymously in an op-ed in the newspaper when Husek was trying to get money from the state. He said, "Any American who doesn't understand the importance of botany should be given a new Latin binomial." And the binomial is Monstrum Americanum.
That's amazing.
I think of that binomial a lot when I think of people, who rub me the wrong way. I think privately, you're a Monstrum Americanum. But it shows you how, some people did understand the importance of botany for the young nation, but a lot of people just didn't get it.
Well, I feel like, we still also continue to have a struggle in the field of botany today. I mean, if you look over the past 20 years, there are many examples of university programs in botany that have been completely eliminated or merged with other departments, or more field botany has been replaced with strictly molecular botany. And so that is a problem where the value of classic botany is not always recognized in institutions.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's, I think it's tragic both in terms of medical progress, but also in terms of plant blindness, because we've many of us have grown up, if we don't have it in our families, you know, people who are really
into hiking or gardening and learn from their parents.
We don't get it. And, you know, I've noticed that children's books now, some of them are starting to name particular species instead of saying, and then, you know, she planted a flower. They'll say, you know, the specific species, or that, you know, she saw a tree and it was a species. And I realized, you know, that for the longest time, we've just had trees and flowers, basically, in our kind of common knowledge.
That's a really great point about with children's literature. Yeah. I think that, so Hossack had this appreciation for botany. He basically was incredibly influenced by his time with Curtis of learning about medicinal plants both in the wild and in Curtis's garden. And was it his vision to bring a piece of that to America and share it with his students? Because he seemed to be, I know that in the book you talk about his enthusiasm for education and how much he really loved to connect with the students.
He was so passionate about educating the next generations of Americans. And he was an incredible teacher. His students wrote down, they wrote down his jokes in their notebooks. And we still have a lot of his students' notes, which is incredible. They're at the Columbia Medical School Library. And so I, you know, I could look in those notes and lecture notes and see what funny things he said, which as a historian is amazing. but he was very passionate about this. And one reason he was so passionate about education and founding civic institutions for the young nations, imagine growing up in Manhattan surrounded by the heroes of the American Revolution. He was the next generation. He was younger than them. He would grow up to know Hamilton, Burr, Jefferson, you know, Madison, Adams, correspond with and know them. And yet he was the next generation. And if you're a teenage boy walking around the streets of New York City, which was briefly the capital of the nation, you are surrounded by heroes of a magnitude we can barely comprehend.
Fathom, yeah.
And for Hossack, for his generation, him and some of his peers, the answer for his, you know, how am I going to be heroic for my young nation is to educate the next generations, to try to create the civic institutions that he had seen in Edinburgh and London and that New York and largely the United States lacked. Philadelphia had some wonderful institutions in Boston, but New York was a commercial backwater at the time. And Hossack set out to create these educational institutions, and then he just threw himself into them. And one of his students, I love this line, wrote home to his parents about Hossack's lectures that he was, he said, when Professor Hossack undertakes to please, he is as good as the theater. Which is great. The best
teaching evaluation,
right?
Theater. That's amazing.
Right.
That's
so amazing. So but he wrote to the Columbia trustees and he said, I can't teach them from books, no matter how entertaining I try to be. I cannot teach botany from books. We need a botanical garden. And he just couldn't raise the funds. He couldn't get people on board. And finally he just went ahead and did it himself.
That's great. A man of action. Yes. And so tell us about this garden. How large was it and where was it located?
Okay. So imagine a map of Manhattan, long, skinny. You know, New York City is located in the 1790s in the very toe of Manhattan. The population was around 30,000 people.
Okay.
The rest of Manhattan is farms and groves, hilly.
So hard to imagine that today, okay.
So Hossack started looking for land. He decided he was going to buy land and create a garden himself and then get the funding. Like a lot of entrepreneurs, he thought, I just have to show people what I'm doing and then they will understand. And so he borrowed money and he found a parcel of land. It was 3.5 miles north of New York City. And so he would go up from the toe of the island where Columbia College was located then, at the, by the way, not up where some people might know it today. It's up in Morningside Heights in northern Manhattan. But he would go up from the toe of Manhattan up a country road called the Middle Road.
Okay.
And he would take his horse or his little carriage up there. And his land was 20 acres. It was hilly. It was stunning. It was covered with mountain laurel and viburnum and violets and forest trees. And he began to hire gardeners and laborers to turn it into his American Eden. And he spent the next 10 years doing this.
Wow. And when he was creating this, tell us about the types of plants he brought in, because he didn't restrict his garden to native plants of the U.S. He was also bringing them from very far away. Like, how did that even happen during that time?
He collected, amazingly, I love the part where he's collecting native species from the beaches of Long Island, from New Jersey, even from the streets of Manhattan, he's collecting native species. But then he was also writing to everyone he could get in touch with, whether they were botanists or lawyers or doctors, all over the world. Mm-hmm. And there were these national and international networks of botanists who were sending plants to hubs like Paris or London from places like Calcutta. There was a botanical garden in Calcutta, and there were plants coming from the Cape of Good Hope and from all over South America. And so he wrote to everybody. And this is one reason it took me so long to research American Eden, and I had to go to 30 different archives around the U.S. and Europe, because his letters got scattered everywhere because he was writing to this international network. And then they would mail – he was asking for plants and seeds, and he wanted dried specimens, and then he also wanted, of course, any kind of living material he could get. But a lot of it arrived dead, I'm sure. I mean, I know he went down to the harbor.
Voyages. Yeah.
So that must have been heartbreaking to wait months for a shipment, go down to the harbor, sign the bill of lading, and then open your box and it's dead. But he did get plants sent to him by the likes of Sir Joseph Banks and Alexander von Humboldt, probably sent him plants. We have some correspondence between them. Thomas Jefferson sent him seeds from Monticello, and you know, he would write Hussack and say, I got these sent to me from Paris. I didn't even bother to open them because I wouldn't be able to package them again. I'm sending them right to you because I know you're the one who should have them. So his botanical garden eventually contained several thousand species. He built a 200-foot conservatory. There was almost nothing like it in the United States at the time. And it was filled with plants from all over the world, and roses. He had so many kinds of roses from around the world, and then all kinds of medicinals, ornamentals. He wanted everything because he didn't know which ones would have medicinal properties after, you know, he conducted research on them. So
tell us a little bit about this research. So he's been laboring to bring in all these different species from his connections across the globe. He's built this Eden where he could not only, I'm sure, enjoy himself, but also bring in students and teach people. And what else did he do in this garden?
He always meant it above all as a research institution. And he would bring students up from Columbia from his classes. He taught a botany class that began in May. Mm-hmm. And the medical students would take this class. And this was sort of before the split between medicine and botany. Mm-hmm. And it was Columbia did have a chemistry lab, but the shift of, you know, the study of medicinal plants hadn't moved into the laboratory yet. Mm-hmm. So Hussack was taking them to the garden. And they would study, he would try to teach them what Curtis had taught him and what he had learned at the Linnaean Society, just the sheer identification. What plants do we know of? What plants do we know have medicinal properties? He was trying to collect case notes. He would sometimes experiment with plants on himself. And I'm sure to some extent on his patients, but not in an experimental way, in a I'm trying to, you know,
cure you
way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, this was before the days of human subjects, you know, protocols. And but they were conducting some chemical experiments. And there's a couple of dissertations that were published by his students that we still have. He wanted to do things like find native replacements for exotic plants, because here's, you know, the war is still being fought with Britain, you know, sort of endlessly on the high seas, even though the revolution was over. And this is the run-up to the War of 1812. So ships are constantly being seized or there's embargoes. And it was really hard to get things like Peruvian bark in to New York regularly. And it was very expensive and you couldn't grow it. So he was trying to identify native replacements for these things.
Well, this is very much what happened also during the American Civil War. We recently did a study on plants that were used as replacements of local native flora for the treatment of things like fever. And at the time, they would call, you know, kind of infections like mortification of the flesh. And these, you know, they didn't have quite the understanding of infection at the time.
Right.
But they knew when things were starting to rot off.
Yes, right.
So
I think that's, I mean, that's, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that's obviously the biggest point, is that this is before they understood the role of microbes in in illnesses, so many illnesses. And so the treatments that Husick was reaching for were still kind of tied to the humoral approach to the body, where you would try to
use purgatives.
Get the body kind of regulated. But he couldn't really deal with infections. So he was kind of moving knowledge forward and then training his students in the scientific methods that he had learned in Edinburgh at the heart of the Scottish Enlightenment, but he wasn't making major, major medical discoveries himself, because he was working in this kind of blindness about infection.
What were some of the causes of some of these infectious diseases, which were really prevalent, and he'd lost children to himself as well. Yeah. All right. So one of the key areas that I think the foodie pharmacology audience is really interested in is this link between food and medicine and what we call the food-medicine continuum. And I know that Husick actually had a huge variety, number one, of different species in his garden, and including many foods and medicinal plants. And I was just wondering, how much did foods as medicine play a role in his medical practice, or were there certain plants that really came out to you as being important in this role?
Yeah, he had lots and lots of edibles in his garden. Some of them he had simply for their, not novelty, but interest. He was interested in all the plants of the world, so he wanted everything. But some of them he specifically labeled in his plant list as being both medically and nutritionally important. And so his plant lists are really, he published two lists, one in 1806 and one in 1811. And he would say, like, medical and diet, or arts, meaning something that could be used to dye cloth or build something with.
Right. So he's really was an ethnobotanist then.
Yes,
he really
was,
understood.
And he always labeled
the multiple roles of plants.
Yeah. He really did. And he had plants that New Yorkers and even most Americans had never seen. So you'd walk into this conservatory that he built, and I mean, the building alone was really unusual.
Was it, what did it look like? Was it glass?
It was a glass and stucco, and it was 20 feet tall in the middle. It had a central hothouse and a central greenhouse and two flanking hothouses. Mm-hmm. And it was on the highest point on his property, and there was only one other that we know of in the United States at the time that was anything like that scale, and that was outside Philadelphia. And when you walked into that, visitors would say, contemporaries would say, that they were enveloped in a swirl of colors and aromas. He had mangoes, kumquats, figs, avocados, coffee trees, acacia, and then a whole desert wing
These are fruits I'm sure that many people had never encountered in their life. I mean, because mangoes, these weren't in common trade at this time.
So I showed his plant list to a group of botanists at the New York Botanical Garden. I convened a discussion of about a half dozen botanists who are experts in different kinds of flora of the world. And they were literally shaking their heads. They were like, how did he get these things at the dawn of the 19th century, all by himself, basically, with, initially no public support? So he had this kind of crazy world that visitors could go up Manhattan Island, up a dirt road. Now that dirt road is Fifth Avenue. And his conservatory that was filled with these incredible plants was is now under the footprint of Radio City Music Hall.
No.
So if you're standing in front of Radio City Music Hall, you're standing in front of Huzzack's former conservatory.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to go there, and just as you did when you closed your eyes.
Close your eyes,
I'm going to go there and close my eyes and try and ignore the honking and just imagine what it must have been like to have this jewel of botanical diversity.
Yeah. So some of these edible plants he used in medicine, in treating his patients. And one was figs. He used a poultice to try to soothe, you know, infections and wounds, open wounds.
Oh, interesting.
And then he used turmeric, much as we do today, to reduce inflammation.
What?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
He used, he had a couple for constipation because in the humoral approach, you would want to purge, you know, you would be very focused on that. So he had chicory for that and pot marigold and tamarind fruit. That was one of his favorites, was tamarind. And then he also had plants that he used for to kind of speed up the circulation, because sluggish circulation was sometimes a diagnosis at the time. Yeah. And so he would use West Indian pepper, so capsicum, and then
well, that certainly does heat things up.
Yes.
Especially if you're under a pretty bland diet of this period. You didn't have a lot of these seasonings and spices.
Exactly.
So
he had ginger. He had he had sweet bay laurel oil he would rub on people's skin. And then he used he had orange trees, and he used that, of course, for the scurvy. But also for, interestingly, the leaves of oranges he would use to make a tea this was common at the time for as an antispasmodic for epilepsy.
Fascinating.
So, you know, one of the things you were saying earlier, there's so many medicinal plants that were in use. We've studied a small sample of those. We also don't know, of the ones that were in use, were they working for what they were intended for?
Well, exactly. And I'm thinking of some of the work on polymethoxyflavones from oranges that I'm actually planning a future episode on. And there's just some amazing chemistry still to be uncovered, even from some of these edible plants that were also, as you said, used as medicine.
Right.
What else pops out to me is I love to think about the movement of plants across the globe and centers of origin. And think about citrus, it originates in Asia, and the journey that a plant has taken through the hands of so many people, traders, botanists, people that were just passionate about diversity in their surroundings, and then to make it all the way to Manhattan with all these other species from India, from South America, Central America, Africa, Europe, all in one place. That's really quite an accomplishment for that era.
That's why I think of it as, and this is why I called the book American Eden, because the thing about the Garden of Eden was that it had, you know, all the versions of this story, it had all these plants from different climates all growing in one place. And so that's why I think of this as Huzzack's American Eden. And thinking of edible plants, Huzzack is about to be immortalized in the most wonderful way. On August 26th, a restaurant is opening on 48th Street, so on his former property, called the Elgin. It's named after his botanical garden, which was called the Elgin Botanic Garden. And it is filled with pictures of his botanical garden, of him and his friends, Hamilton Burr and other friends.
That's amazing. Wow.
And the best part of it is that a botanist from the New York Botanical Garden named Daniel Atha has pressed a series of specimens for the walls that are framed on the walls that represents plants Huzzack was growing on the property. That's going to be, it's a total coincidence. They were working on it when the book came out, and so I started working with them on how to represent Huzzack's world and the botanical garden world. So you can go, and there are sort of nods to him in the menu and in the drinks
list. Oh, my gosh.
I've got to
check this place out. This is amazing.
Huzzack's birthday, 250th birthday, is August 31st.
Wow.
So it's a great time to go lift a glass to Huzzack,
The
Elgin on 48th Street.
Wow. That's amazing. What a fascinating human being that, I mean, and we talk about his contributions with this garden, but also I imagine that all of the influence that he had on the physicians that he trained over mm-hmm. the years and brought them this high level of appreciation of botanicals that I'm sure influenced many generations to come following them. So, I mean, that's really impressive.
Yeah, physicians, and he helped bring into being the first generation of American professional botanists. Shifting from polymaths and nurserymen to actually, you know, ending up with botany departments in the 19th century in New York City and elsewhere.
Wow.
And then his grand students, so to speak, went on to found the New York Botanical Garden.
Wow. That's great. So as you were on this journey of research, what about this was, I guess, gave you the greatest surprise? What was most surprising to you as you were digging into this this amazing history?
I mean, that's a question. I have like 20 answers because it was 8 years on and off of research and writing, and it was just the most thrilling series of discoveries. The biggest was the first one, which the one that led me to write the book, and it wasn't my discovery. It was reading somebody's secondary work and just these couple of sentences about the fact that the first public botanical garden in the United States is now, that land, Huzzick's land, is now Rockefeller Center.
What? That's amazing. Yeah.
And that juxtaposition is why I just went, I'm dropping
wow.
everything I can. You know, you have a full life and you have teaching duties. And I wrapped up whatever research I was working on and I just went. I wanted to understand that transition from one of, you know, from a pastoral Manhattan to one of the most iconic urban spaces in the world. And that journey, then what I discovered was this man who no one remembers was one of the most famous Americans of his day who wasn't a politician. You know, the politicians mm-hmm. were more famous, but some people remember him because he was chosen by his dear friends and patients, Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, to be the attending physician at their famous duel.
The famous duel, yeah.
But that's where some people, you know, when I ask people in the audiences of my book talks, have you ever heard of him? If they have, it's either for that reason or it's, you know, a botanist who might have come across him because there is a plant named for him, Hosakia, named for him by David Douglas, the Scottish botanist. But to discover this man who had, in addition to the botanical garden, he founded or co-founded about a dozen other New York institutions. So he was kind of helping make New York, New York, and helping make the United States by creating these institutions that give us our kind of city fabric, our national life. And to see that someone who had done so much for the young nation was completely forgotten, that really drove me to want to tell his story. And it's been an amazing ride the last year.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Victoria. This has been just a fascinating discussion, and I can't wait to hear your lecture tonight at the Gardens.
Thank you so much for having
me. And I know you have an amazing lineup of upcoming speaking events. Where can our audience find out more about your upcoming events? And I'm sure that there will be some that would love to see you in person.
Thank you for asking that. I am giving a lot more talks coming up this academic year, and I have a website where even more importantly than learning about my talks, you can learn more about
Absolutely.
David Huzzick
yes.
and his work, and that's AmericanEden.org.
Great, AmericanEden.org, and you can find Victoria's books in any major bookseller. There are links also on the website, and just thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay, great.
I hope you enjoyed this special episode of Foodie Pharmacology. I've learned so much from speaking with Victoria and reading her fantastic book. I encourage you to check out AmericanEden.org to learn more about this fascinating work. American Eden can be purchased from all major booksellers, and links to purchase are also provided on the website. Next time on Foodie Pharmacology, I'm going to introduce you to one of my chef heroes to chat about his latest work in Indigenous foodways. I first met Chef Sean Sherman last year at a meeting of the Society for Economic Botany, where he was attending as a plenary speaker, and his company, the Sous Chef, catered the event with a beautiful banquet made of local Indigenous ingredients. Chef Sean's cookbook, The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, not only won the James Beard Medal for Best American Cookbook for 2018, but he also won the 2019 Leadership Award by the James Beard Foundation. I'm thrilled to have a chance to speak with him about his latest work and one of his favorite Indigenous ingredients, Labrador tea. So tune in next time to learn more. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the podcast for the food curious, recorded in Atlanta, Georgia at the Emory University Center for Digital Scholarship. You can subscribe to the podcast on SoundCloud or iTunes. Spread the word and tell your friends. If you've got a great idea for a future guest on the show, reach out to me and let me know. You can also find me on our Foodie Pharmacology Facebook page or Twitter and Instagram at Quave Ethnobot, spelled Q-U-A-V-E-E-T-H-N-O-B-O-T. I'll see you next time.